HST is stupid. Let me tell you, us guys ain't dumb. People wave at Campbell with their middle fingers. Tell him he can stick it in his bum. It's 12% to fix your broken old oven. The tax and pizza deliveries. You're paying more for your medication. It doesn't sound like harmony.
Let's tax them.
What did you just say?
Let's tax them.
I should have learned to be a politician. I need a drink of Gordo's rum. Look at that Campbell. He's still smiling for the cameras, man. Has he gone mad, son? Who's up there? What's that? It's freaking Colin Hanson. He's Campbell's organ grinder and his chimpanzee. Oh, that's just perfect. And that's the way they do us, stuff in their pockets with the HST. Easy, easy money for nothing. A bunch of dicks to me. We're all hurting.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking and weird songs about taxes. Well, my name is Ethan. You're a free thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
This is Don. You're a political science and philosopher. Hoping I'm not going to tax you today.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and recently returned from a trip to Whistler.
This is Daniel, economics student.
And we have a special guest in the studio with us today, Rob Tarswell.
Great to be back.
Making his second appearance on the show, the first time it disappeared due to a technical error.
I really hope that doesn't happen again.
It's a conspiracy, I'm sure.
Yeah, actually, if you're listening live, it might be a good idea to start recording.
Yeah, we have a history of losing episodes when we have professionals on the show.
Speaking of having a history of losing, that intro song, that reminded me of a classic, you know, 80s song, but the lyrics were all different. What was that all about?
Well, I believe it's a relation to a controversial new tax idea that's being floated around out there. And maybe Daniel, you could fill us in a bit on that. Daniel.
We very recently received an email asking us to go over the HST. We did look at it back last year on our November 1st episode. I can't remember the exact number, but if you want to go back and listen to it, we talked about it for like 15 minutes, so we'll just quickly go over it again, maybe with some new insights. The basic reason for the HST is that the PST and GST are actually different taxes. Most people think they're pretty much the same, but they apply to different things. So the PST is exempt most notably on services, whereas the GST, you do pay that, and the HST is like the GST. So now you will be paying extra tax for services like restaurants, getting haircuts, whatever.
But they're both consumption taxes, which is something that a lot of people argue about. As in, the more you spend, the more you pay of this tax. Although now, instead of paying it on different things, it's all one tax that's applied to most everything.
Yes, it's now a consumption tax on pretty much everything. But there's one other key change that, and this is the major reason why economists like it, like this tax over something like an income tax. The PST applies to goods purchased for investment into producing other goods. So, for instance, a home builder, all the materials they buy to build a home, there would be PST charged on that, whereas HST will not be charged on that. So what this does is it adds a huge incentive for investment in BC.
Or it's a big tax break to those people who are owners of businesses.
Yes, it does shift the tax burden, but ultimately it is good for people in BC for more investment to come here. If you look at the provinces that have changed to HST, their investment went up about 12.2% above other provinces that didn't. But yes, as you said, it does change the tax burden. It does put it on more on consumers, especially lower income consumers. And so there are good and bads to the HST.
And so presumably the reason the public is up in arms over the HST is because of this shift to taxing the consumer.
Yeah, it's easy for everyone to see how this is going to make certain things more expensive for them, but it's harder for them to see how it might be in the long term beneficial to BC.
Well, and if I remember correctly, in those other provinces that have created a harmonized tax, which is the Maritimes ones I saw anyhow, is that actually there was very little in savings, that the cost of living did increase in both in the short run and in the long run.
If you go back to the past one we did on this, I had better statistics in front of me, but if I remember correctly, certain things, the price actually dropped, which is weird when you have 3% inflation. So that means it's really dropping more than 3%, even if it's only like a 1% drop. But yes, some other things do go up, most notably housing, because there's a bigger tax on it.
We'll put a link up to that archived episode in the show notes when we put up this one on our website at radiofreethinker.com.
Yes, and I do encourage our listeners. We got a few emails about this topic, and we're happy to discuss it more. So if you guys have thoughts, criticisms, concerns that we're not addressing, let us know, and we'll address it at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
I think one of the interesting things, and this is sideline, this isn't directly HST, but I received an email recently about how will the HST impact you, and it was a little calculator. You go to a website and you say, you know, this is how much I spend on coffee a month, this is how much whatever, and then you hit the little calculator button and said, oh, it's going to cost you $500 a month, and then right underneath that it says donate this amount of money to help fight the GST. And I'm going, well, it seemed like a really weird ploy to solicit money. It was obvious in your face. It's like, oh, I'm going to spend this money anyhow. Might as well spend it to defeat it. But I don't know. The politicalness of this, the idea that the NDP and Van der Zand are joining together in league against this, strikes me that the political aspect of this is way outshining the economic arguments, both pro or against.
Right. And that's where the evidence, I think, will be found, not in sort of political money grubbing, getting into bed with people. So yeah, if we're going to discuss this, let's definitely keep it in the realm of economics, where there actually might be a science to this. I said might, haha. Anyway, why don't we move on to another topic that I'm sure all of our listeners have heard about, I know Rob has, and that is a tragedy for Poland. On April 10th, a plane carrying the Polish president along with 96 passengers, including several high-ranking members of the Polish government and military, crashed in Smolensk, is that right?
Smolensk,
Russia. Very tragic instance. It's thrown the Polish government into something of a bit of a chaos. They were en route to a memorial of the 70th anniversary of the, how do you say that, Rob? Katyn massacre?
Katyn.
That. In which Soviet forces massacred a bunch of Polish
For those people who aren't aware, sorry, that Rob is our resident Polish scholar and
You would not expert. Believe how many people I know have forwarded this story to me based entirely on the fact that they know I'm Polish.
Yes. Well, it happens when anything happens in Canada to me, so the cause of this crash appears to be that the pilots attempted to land the plane despite heavy fog and warnings from the Russian air control that it wasn't safe. The plane, as it was descended, clipped some trees, lost control, and crashed into the ground.
But because of the proximity to the memorial and the fact that they crashed in a forest pretty much right near where the massacre happened, and it was the first time that any of these Polish officials at any time were going to memorialize this event in Russia, has got conspiracy theorists all up in arms.
Well, it comes at a very bad time for Russian-Polish relations, particularly icy of the past year or so. And it's given a lot of people what they think is, you know, the perfect piece of evidence that, oh, look, the Russian forces have assassinated the Polish government.
Even the fact that this was going on, because wasn't it a big thing as well that Putin was going to show up for this thing, which is, again, another first in the history of this event, this memorial?
Right, yeah. It's very controversial in Russia right now. As we've mentioned before, there's sort of this revival, this nostalgia for the past in Russia that's got a few people sort of on edge in Eastern Europe.
Not only that, but the Chechens are actually blowing people up as a result of it.
Yeah, it's a messy situation. So what I find interesting is, despite the fact that both sides, both the Polish investigation and the Russian investigation, have confirmed through, I guess, examining, you know, the plane's black box or whatever, that they were, in fact, warned not to land the plane. They did anyway. And there's speculation that maybe the Polish president ordered the plane to land. He didn't want to be late for the ceremony. If that's the case, it, you know, obviously cast a certain bit of light on this. I was actually interested to note that there are two conspiracy theories. There's the one that says the Russian government, the Kremlin, was involved. The other being that it was the Polish opposition party who wanted to clear the way for a coup. So, Rob, you're our resident expert. Is that possible?
I can't say much about either conspiracy theory, but I can say, I mean, and this is anecdotal, just based on meeting Polish people and traveling in Poland. Political hero worship is huge in Poland. Lech Wałęsa, the guy who created the Solidarity Movement and basically ended Soviet occupation of Poland, is worshipped like a lot by the Polish public. And so they very, very much respect political figures and authority figures in Poland. So I think the idea that the president of Poland, or that the pilot of this, you know, plane full of authority figures were at fault, and it was their fault that they crashed, is inconceivable to the Polish public. Mm-hmm. And so people latch on this and suggest that, well, it was a conspiracy. The government did it, or opposition political party did it, and then you're off to the races. Conspiracy theorists can jump on this idea, and because you don't want to support the idea that your own, you know, political heroes or authoritarian figures were responsible, it's really easy to find evidence that something else happened.
Speaking of hero worshiping, I understand there's another famous person who came from Poland, the Pope, the late Pope.
He didn't come from Poland. The late Pope. Yeah, the previous
the late
Pope. Yeah.
Right. And haven't I thought I heard somewhere that there was a link that the troubles that the Catholic Church have been having is all part of this. You know, this is just another attempt of non-Catholics trying to kill Catholics.
I actually saw on some Polish news outlets that, like, both of these stories were on the front page, and opinions and commentary were basically saying that how much more can the Polish people take? They're attacking the Catholic Church, and the government is in collapse, and what is the world doing to us? And it's just like, well, I'm not. These stories aren't related. And the crash, at least, seems to be due to human error, not any sort of conspiracy.
Well, why don't we take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we were just talking about some conspiracy theories. Let's talk a bit about the brain, though. And what have you learned about the brain, Rob?
So in my weekly scouring of news stories about science, I discovered a couple of cool studies on psychology. One of them was just published at the end of March in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And it revolved around the idea that our moral judgments can be manipulated. So what this study did was it built on some research that showed that the right temporoparietal junction, which is an area on the brain right above your ear and a little behind, on the right side of the head, that seems to be involved in thinking about other people's beliefs and intentions and what thoughts other people are having, basically. And that's also been implicated in showing up when people are making judgments about what other people are doing, whether it's moral or not. So using transcranial magnetic stimulation, researchers basically take this magnetic wand and hold it up to the head, and it prevents neurons from firing, prevents them from working for a temporary period of time. And they had people make moral judgments about other people's actions during this stimulation of their temporoparietal junction. And they found that their moral judgments changed. Specifically, foiled attempts to harm were judged okay, when normally, and this is a very robust effect, intended attempts to harm that fail are still judged as morally incorrect because the intention was there. So when you shut off the area of the brain that's involved in thinking about what other people's intentions are, it's very difficult to be consistent in your moral judgments about someone else's intentions. It's based entirely on whether the action succeeded or not, which I thought was pretty interesting.
I took a look at this study, and actually it was on another podcast. They talked about the study. And one of the things that we were talking about before the show was that the number of people involved in the study was rather small, and the effects themselves were rather small. Statistically significant, but still rather minor.
I saw this too, and I thought that one reason that it was a bit more robust than SDU, which was the other podcast, might have given it credit for, was that it meshes really nicely with other research done in this area. As I said before, it was based on previous research that shows that this area is involved in judgments about other people's intentions and beliefs. This is based on people who have had brain damage to this area being unable to do it. It's based on brain imaging studies showing this area to be active when people are making judgments about other people's intentions, and all sorts of studies that sort of mesh really nicely with the results of this one.
So can we take this study and say that it applies to people who are psychopaths, who can't recognize their actions harming other people? Would they perhaps have less activity in this part of their brain?
It's entirely possible. I've seen studies that show that psychopaths have decreased or increased activity in other parts of the brain. I'm not sure about this one. But actually, one thing that on the blog Neurophilosophy was suggested was that this relates to autistic children, where one theory of autism is that people who have autism have an impaired theory of mind. They have an impaired ability to think about what other people's beliefs, thoughts, and intentions are. And some evidence suggests that in autistic people, the right temporoparietal junction matures much later in life.
Interesting. Well, why don't we shift gears from the brain to cigarettes? And our Dr. Rob...
We're not even trying to do segues anymore.
Yeah, we gave up on those a long time ago. So Dr. Rob, to differentiate between normal Rob, Dr. Rob, is going to talk to us a bit about anti-smoking legislation. And does it actually work?
Well, the evidence is in, and it's a compelling yes. In fact, a recent study in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, which got nice coverage in the front page of the Globe and Mail today, shows that a significant drop for cardiovascular conditions, respiratory conditions, a bit less of a drop in heart attacks was noted in a multi-year period looking at hospital admission rates in suburbs of Toronto that eliminated smoking from workplaces, bars, and restaurants versus workplaces that didn't, which showed no significant change and actually slight increases in some of these areas. One of the interesting findings, which probably wasn't anticipated, was the heart attack rate going down 17% in Toronto over the period studied, which I think was 2003 to 2006, looking at a broader period of 1999 to 2009 when changes were fully rolled out. And that represents about a 1 in 5 decrease in hospitalization rates for just merely smoking in restaurants and bars. And one of the interesting comments that Richard Stanwyck made, and he's the chief public health officer on Vancouver Island, is that in Victoria, after they put these bans in place, they were actually able to fire a cardiologist because there wasn't enough for him to do in the emergency departments.
Wow. That's bad for that guy, but I guess good for the rest of us.
Well, it's like, you know, if you're working in an industry where your job is to fix problems, it's kind of the thing where like the old quote, you're doing well if you're no longer needed.
Yeah.
You probably got a better paying job in the U.S. anyway. Yeah.
Well, it raises a question here. Now, is it simply banning cigarettes in restaurants? Or, I mean, I seem to recall there's a huge buildup of anti-smoking stuff out there. Everything from, you know, graphic photos on the front of packages to commercials and public awareness campaigns. Is this because we banned smoking in restaurants, or is it because of a long history of anti-smoking campaigns?
Well, it's certainly multifactorial. The interesting thing in this CMAJ study is that the most precipitous drops were noted almost immediately after bans came into place. And they had the ability to test this in multiple phases. So after the restaurant cutting out of smoking, which came before bars in Toronto, major drop. And then when they cut it in bars, there was another major drop. Not as major as the restaurants, but that's simply because there are so many more restaurants than bars. So there's good reasons to think that this is a genuine cause and effect relationship. Plus, when they studied the rates of control conditions leading to admissions, such as inflammation of the gallbladder, they noted no statistically significant change over time. And they compared with rates of hospitalization admission for respiratory and cardiovascular conditions and heart attacks in places like Thunder Bay, which didn't roll out the same smoking ban. So multiple lines of evidence would suggest that this really is a cause and effect relationship, and a substantial one.
Wow, that's impressive.
So given that it's a strong looking effect, what do you think about people who have been reporting the story and saying that it's secondhand smoking that is the problem? So they ban smoking in restaurants, and less people get admitted to the hospital for smoking related health problems. Is this due to the reduction of secondhand smoking, or is this due to the reduction of just firsthand smokers being admitted?
Right, so this is a good question. We do know that bans have led to reductions in numbers of smokers, but certainly the number of smokers did not drop within a 2 to 3 year period by one third. So it seems pretty safe to say that most of the effect we're observing is a drop in morbidity from secondhand smoke, because the smokers are still smoking. They're just all shivering on the sidewalk doing it. It's the rest of us who are sitting in the restaurant or the bar that aren't getting exposed, and we're not getting asthma flare-ups, bronchitis, chest pain, or heart attacks.
Could it also be, though, that the people who do smoke are smoking less because they aren't allowed to do it in these restaurants and bars?
Very good question, and I personally don't know the answer to that, but that would be a great area to look at in terms of the burden of disease or the dose-response effect of primary smoking and morbidity, which certainly we know is a well-established and strong relationship in cardiovascular disease and cancers.
Actually, I think there's another interesting aspect to this in a way, and this is going out of your field of thing, but we say banning, but I mean smoking is still allowed. It's not an illegal drug as opposed to some other things. And the idea of social control over this as opposed to legal control. What do you think this can extend to other things? I mean, I know right now in New York that there's a ban on high fructose sugar and high sugar things. And is this where bad science meets good science? Or?
Don't go too far into this. I'm planning on making this a show topic.
Oh, well, but the idea is this evidence of how social control can change the health of a society as opposed to mandating control?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, the first number of attempts to ban smoking in bars and restaurants just failed miserably because there was simply no public appetite or political appetite to tackle the issue. But at some point, socially, some sort of tipping point appeared to be reached. The public was ready. Then the legislation went through. But it appears to be the actual ban itself that made the big difference. Social pressure, people getting dirty looks in bars and restaurants wasn't really, if I recall the early 90s correctly, when this was all starting to come into play, didn't seem to make much of a difference in terms of smoking.
Actually, speaking of social pressure and switching topics a little bit, I was listening to the CBC News this morning, and they had a very interesting thing about this woman who is the mother of a daughter who was not allowed to go to school today because she wasn't vaccinated against, was it measles? I'm not sure it's measles or mumps, whatever. And she was so indignant that, she had done this choice and she was not allowing her children to go there. And she was even more upset because yesterday she had her child vaccinated. So why won't they let her child go in today? And I was just thinking, with regards to social pressure and all that, I mean, and the anti-vax movement, its ups and downs, what do you think of that?
That's pretty interesting, and that's a bold move on the part of the school board. I mean, it's good that the child ultimately got vaccinated. Of course, it'd be far too early for that vaccine to actually be showing a decent immunogenic response yet. I guess my question would be, are they worried because of confirmed cases of measles in the school? I would think that maybe it was a public health measure. But, you make a free choice that affects the rest of us, and I'll go on a bit of a soapbox here that has nothing to do with medical practice. We're going to make a response, and you may not like that.
Well, we've reported several measles outbreaks in the last couple of months. There was one in the interior. There was one in Vancouver pretty recently. So, I mean, and I was actually listening to a TED Talk today by Michael Spector saying that vaccination rates are actually dropping for the measles in North America. Phenomenally scary because here's a disease that is very infectious and could conceivably, kill somebody, kill a child, and, we'll be left going, well, we told you so. And
it's hard, hollow victory, right?
Yeah, we don't want it to go that far, but I'm very afraid that it's going to have to.
Well, and then the question will be, would that even be enough? Because one of the paradoxes that are coming out of the U.S. data is that vaccine refusal is actually happening among families of higher socioeconomic status, folks who perhaps don't know what they don't know and are maybe not, are more than self-confident in their ability to parse the data. Yeah, there have been a lot of measles outbreaks, and in fact, Boston just last year, had the largest outbreaks of mumps that have been known since the introduction of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, the MMR vaccine. So it's really happening, folks. The epidemics are returning. Measles is, in fact, now pandemic again in the United Kingdom. Way to go, Great Britain. And it's going to happen here. So there seems to be a deeper issue of some sort of fear of the unknown, the unknowns of the vaccine, and an inability to really assess the risks of the disease, because we don't see these diseases anymore. So as so often is the case, public health is a victim of its own success.
Sort of like our cardiac guy who no longer has a job.
Well, hopefully it'll get so good that we'll all be fired.
Well, I think that we should take a break. And when we're back, we'll be back with more public health scaremongering as we talk about Homeopathy Awareness Week.
Well said.
Yeah, this is Mickey Fitz from The Business. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Keep the faith.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
You know, a listener of mine pointed out that the last show we had, I had a lot of these gaps where I forgot what I was going to say. And it, you know, turns out that actually I have a malabsorption of B12, which is can be a very, very serious medical condition. So I've decided, and I don't want people to worry, but I'm going to take a very risky and dangerous course of action here. I'm actually going to trust Western medicine. I'm going to go see a doctor.
You fool!
And actually get treated, as opposed to perhaps go to some homeopath who's going to say, you know, if you just eat your meal facing the sun, and if you, you know, if you have this particular water, and when's the last time you had an enema? Which, of course, is no one's business but my own.
Well, actually, it's just that kind of misattribution to what homeopaths actually do that Homeopathy Awareness Week has been started for. That's right, listeners. This week is National or International Homeopathy Awareness Week, and we are going to do our part to tell you all about what homeopathy really is.
And since we have Dr. Rob Tarswell here, I have a few questions that hopefully he can answer about homeopathy. So, Dr. Rob, what is homeopathy? Is it really a small substance diluted into relatively huge quantities of water and then shaken magically to make the water remember the essence of the substance?
That would be the pharmacological practice of homeopathy. The philosophical foundation of homeopathy is that like cures like. I forget the specific Latin phrase. But when Hahnemann first proposed the principles of homeopathy in the centuries gone by, I think it was late 18th century, if memory serves, at that point, Western medicine, so-called, was just as gory and had really only recently discovered such bold and vital things like, well, the heart actually acts as a pump. It doesn't just push blood out to the tissues that gets magically consumed. So my forebears hadn't really gone that far to the gate and were doing all kinds of crazy things that had no evidence-based at all, but were simply based on tradition. Well, at one point, we hitched our wagon to science, and guess what? That worked. So, seen from the lens of the day, homeopathy was relatively benign interventions for what were largely benign conditions and self-limited, but at least it didn't kill people, which primitive medicine most certainly did, particularly surgical interventions. Now, the problem is that as science has marched on, we've discovered that there's no foundation whatsoever to like cures like. So if you get an infection, typically we don't give you more viruses or bacteria, even in a highly diluted form. This has now been demonstrated over and over again from any line of evidence conceivable to essentially be wishful thinking. It started from, I think, a reasonably well-motivated and compassionate place, but it has hung on tenaciously long after its best before date.
If I remember correctly, Nathan, you being our resident historian, that the doctor, the traditional doctor, was more like palliative cares to make you feel comfortable and all that, and the advent of medicine. So in a sense, this is sort of the idea is we'll try and make you comfortable and the idea of sympathetic magic. I just think it's so crazy in the one sense. If I get into a car accident and I break my leg, in a way, the logic of this is, well, you should get into another car accident to fix it.
But a really little car accident, possibly in a swimming pool.
Yes, diluted and shaken. Well, I have a question then. So why do people say they took homeopathy and it made them feel better?
Because merely taking action on your problems will make you feel better. This has been demonstrated over and over again, particularly an interest in my field of medicine, psychiatry. And there's an old saw in psychotherapy, once begun, half done. By the time you decide to get off the couch, call a therapist, and sit down in front of them starting to work, you're already starting to feel better. And that makes sense. So you go to a homeopath and decide, okay, this non-specific vague itch really bothers me. You get in there, somebody listens to you, says, yeah, you know what, I think I know exactly what's going on. I think I know exactly how to treat that. Wow, so here's this authority figure who takes me seriously, who understands me, says that they can help out. Well, this is fantastic. And this is, in some quarters, called the placebo effect, although I think specifically the placebo effect properly should be applied to pharmacological or surgical interventions. The relationship that's transacted between a patient or someone suffering and a caregiver is a very complex one, and it's one that's especially of interest to psychological and psychiatric researchers, because this is part of what I think makes homeopathy, naturopathy, and chiropractic successful. These days, you go in to see your family doctor who gets paid about $35 or $40 to see you. The family doctor's got a secretary, has got to keep the lights on, got to keep the door open, and has to, and we've all experienced this, right? They're already pulling out the pad before you've even opened your mouth, and you're out the door, and you're like, "What? Well, what just happened there?" Even if it was reasonably competent and they only needed a few questions, put the stethoscope here, order this test, there's a real value in slowing down and reassuring somebody's anxiety. And you go to the naturopath and you pay your $200 for your hour of time. Well, you get your hour of time. And there may not be anything medically efficacious going on there, but you're being heard and validated and understood and told there's nothing to worry about. These are psychologically very powerful.
On a couple of episodes ago, we actually covered some stories from all over the place that were talking about the doctor-patient relationship and programs that had tried to get the doctors and patients to ask each other more questions, to communicate more, to increase compliance with treatments and stuff like that. And it just seems like that there's this huge problem with, you know, I hesitate to call it Western medicine because that's the term used by people who don't really like it, but with Western medical practitioners actually listening to their patients, whereas quack doctors, homeopaths, whatever, are totally willing to sit down and say whatever you want to hear.
Right. And perhaps our in-house economists might be able to address this better, but there's perhaps issues of how doctors are incentivized within a fee-for-service system versus, say, doctors who receive a salary and therefore don't need to worry about churning the mill in order to keep the lights on. They can take the time, and I've had, you know, opportunities to witness and work in and see the interactions from both sides. And there's certainly the advantages to fee-for-service, there's advantage to salary-based practice, but it's pretty clear that if you want the time to be heard, you should find a family doctor who gets a salary. But then instead of waiting 6 weeks to get in to see your family doctor, maybe you're going to be looking at a 12-week wait if everyone gets all the time that they feel they need and deserve rather than the time they actually need to get a proper diagnosis and a treatment plan.
Isn't another confounding factor with this is, one, a lot of these people who claim that their holistic or homeopathic thing cured them were also taking Western medicine at the same time. And the fact that, I mean, the human body, although we live a lot longer now, is a fantastic machine for fighting off infections and that type of thing. And a lot of the things that ail us, we will recover from just because our body's efficient in that way.
Yeah, you're going to survive every disease in your life except one. And this certainly would apply sitting in the homeopath's office. The thing to bear in mind in terms of, say, self-limited conditions is, yeah, you take a condition like, say, a cold, and sit on your couch and do nothing but shiver under a blanket, and in 7 to 10 days you'll feel better. You go to a homeopath, you get some long-named flower drops to put under your tongue, and in about 7 to 10 days you're going to feel a lot better. You go into your family doctor who says it's just a cold, go home, and in 7 to 10 days you'll feel better. It's going to be the same.
So to continue with the hard questions, given that homeopathy doesn't work but makes you feel better, and given that going to a regular doctor might take a long time or might be unsatisfying, why shouldn't people go to a homeopath?
Well, I think you shouldn't go to a homeopath because you're going to get lied to about how your body works, how the universe works, and what the real mechanisms of disease and cure are. That's the main reason you shouldn't go to a homeopath. Now, does that mean that we should have legislation preventing homeopaths or people from going to homeopaths? No, but I think a real caveat emptor is to be considered. One of the things that really is a burr under my saddle when it comes to alternative practitioners is I've yet to find one who will say, oh, gee, you know, we really don't have a good approach to what you've got. Whereas in my work, frequently, particularly in the chronic pain program, about half of my day was spent saying, you know, I don't really know what's going to help you. We can try some things and we can come up with an approach and we can at least try to ground it in the best evidence available, but I don't want to make any promises up front that I'm going to have to break.
You know, that, of course, see, you're laboring under a terrible, terrible burden of being reality-based medicine, where if you're not reality-based medicine, you can make things up and you can cover any eventuality.
Absolutely, and it would be delightful to be able to say to someone, yeah, don't worry, you know, we're going to take care of it, it's going to be fine. But really, that, I think, is the kind of language that's appropriate for small children. But when we enter the adult world, we need to face the reality that sometimes we have problems that there perhaps isn't any good approach to at all.
Well, we've heard stories about people taking homeopathy and coming to bad ends, but to play devil's advocate once more, I mean, don't drug companies make drugs that sometimes don't work? Why would it be any different with homeopathy?
Right, so the best, I mean, there's all sorts of examples. I think the gold standard case, of course, would be thalidomide, which appeared to be just great in all the animal trials. Then it was released as initially a cure for morning sickness, and then a very high rate of children with horrendous limb anomalies was born. And it was ultimately discovered that the drug itself, one of the stereoisomers, or one of the shapes that the drug could take, was actually able to insert itself in between DNA sequences and shut off certain sequences related to limb growth. In fact, thalidomide's made a comeback with that stereoisomer removed. But the idea that arose was, oh, hey, maybe drugs aren't always good things. And certainly they're not. The folks who make drugs do that to make a profit. But what's the best way to make a profit? Well, you sell a product that works. So then the next step is, well, how do you show that the product works? Well, you do science. But then the problem is, well, who pays for the science? If Pfizer wants to introduce a new pill to the market, on the one hand, it's a good argument to say, well, Pfizer should prove to us that this works. And Pfizer's more than happy to say, well, we have all kinds of studies that prove that this works, and you should just go ahead and pass it. At least there is a much better awareness now than, say, even 5 or 10 years ago about the kinds of chicanery and buried studies and the way that a drug gets brought to market. And finally, medical journal editors had enough and put their foot down collectively about a decade ago saying, okay, listen, Big Pharma, you want us to publish your gee whiz study? Well, you'd better have registered in a publicly accessible trials database every study done on this drug. You don't have to publish them all, but they all have to be there, and we have to know if this was just one positive study in a batch of 72 studies, all the other 71 of which showed nothing at all. Now, on the other hand, we come to the other version, which would be what I would like to call big placebo. Don't be fooled. There is a very large and lucrative industry that creates homeopathic remedies and naturopathic remedies. And it currently faces no burden of proof whatsoever, and in fact is fighting tooth and nail for even basic ideas like this compound contains X percent of some long Latin name flower. They're fighting tooth and nail against this and arguing it's a freedom of speech issue and blah, 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 blah. And Big Placebo is not going to go down without fighting because they've got billions on the line too.
Wow. One last question, and this is really important. Rob Tarswell, are you now or have you ever been a shill for Big Pharma?
I'm afraid I haven't. Although I will admit that I have occasionally begrudgingly left my home and my family, such as it has been, to go out to some drug-sponsored dinner, listen to some slick used car salesman type pitch for a bit of rubber chicken and a couple glasses of house wine, staring at my watch the whole time wondering when I can get the hell out of there. That's about as far as I've gone into the world of Big Pharma.
Okay, well, that's good to have that on record.
I just have one question to wrap up with. What's the one thing you wish anyone who is considering trying homeopathy would know?
Well, just know that you're unlikely to be harmed by trying that homeopathic remedy because there's nothing in it except, well, water if it's liquid, although sometimes they put it in a tincture of alcohol, which can be quite pleasing for reasons completely unrelated to homeopathy. Or if you're lactose intolerant, beware of those tablets because lactose is the stabilizer.
Well, well said. Let's go to a commercial break and we'll be back with more on Radio Freethinker.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my
bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
Bike the Blossoms with CITR and the Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition on Saturday, April 17th. A scenic bike ride and cultural experience, Bike the Blossoms provides a perfect way to see the natural beauty of Vancouver's cherry blossoms. Take advantage of on-site bike mechanics, enjoy refreshments, live music, and CITR DJs at the Museum of Vancouver. Bike the Blossoms, Saturday, April 17th. Registration is $10 and $8 for CITR members and Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition members. Kids 16 and under ride free. Register online at greatrides.ca.
I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
We're back on Radio Freethinker. We should remind our listeners on Friday, April 16th, Dr. Rob Tarswell will debate Dr. Hugh Ross on the existence of God here at UBC in Woodward Building, room number 2 at 7 p.m. First question. Why do you want to debate Hugh Ross?
Well, I think Hugh Ross, interestingly, is a guy worth debating because he wants to bring the question of God's existence into the empirical realm. And he brings hypotheses, models, and data, all of which I happen to think are wrong. But if you're going to go about this question of the existence of an ultimate cause of the universe and you want to posit that it's all powerful and personal, well, ultimately, this entity is either part of the total universe or not. And if so, if you want to demonstrate the existence of that being, you'd better be able to boil that down to empirical approaches. Otherwise, we have nothing to talk about. It's some sort of Kierkegaardian leap of faith, and you're free to make that leap. But please don't tell me that I'm going to be frying in a lake of fire for all of eternity, because I don't make the same leap.
So, I mean, we were just talking about medicine. Obviously, your background is a doctor. So, do you have experience with theology? What's your background in the realm of God and the supernatural?
Well, I actually used to really groove on Hugh Ross because I was a Christian for about 13 years and interested in rationally defending Christianity, which paradoxically ultimately led to my Christian undoing about 15 years ago. So I have a lot of sympathy for Christians who want to say, well, now, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, this might be an act of faith, but we think that there are sufficient empirical grounds to go ahead and make this decision. Well, of course, I mean, just a quick sidebar, it leads to the question of, well, if there are sufficient empirical grounds, it seems to be a matter of knowledge rather than a matter of belief or faith. But we'll leave that to the side. The thing I find interesting about Dr. Ross is that he's trying to make it an empirical question, so we're going to tackle it on empirical grounds Friday night.
As I understand it, this is sponsored by an organization called Reasons to Believe. So it's sort of focusing on the reasons rather than just believing.
Yeah.
And I should point out, the Center for Inquiry, Vancouver.
And UBC Freethinkers.
And... Oh, no, I guess that's just it. sorry, there's one question. I was listening to, a theologian a while ago who was defending the classic version of Christianity. It was some really weird, bizarre thing that maybe 1 in 1,000 people might believe in. 1 in 1,000. So what is Hugh Ross's version of God? What is he defending? Did you know that beforehand?
Well, I mean, the nice thing, again, you know, one of the things I think is reasonably noble about the Reasons to Believe organization is they've got a website that says exactly what they believe, and here's their statement of beliefs, and it's pretty clear language, and they've got preliminary essays. They also sell books. I mean, I think this is how they make their living and, you know, pay their bills. But it's a sort of a standard Protestant theological concept of the triune God, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, and omnibenevolent as the creator of the universe. So I don't think there are going to be any surprises that way.
Do you, when you go into this debate, do you expect to change somebody's mind?
I don't expect to change anybody's mind. What I would like to do would be to plant the seeds of potential change. And that's why I'm going to be taking an intentional stance of being conciliatory on a personal level and conveying respect for the project, if not for the conclusion, and not trying to get into anything that's acrimonious, which might make great for boring YouTube clips, but if we're trying to actually... as George Bush would say, win hearts and minds, then we really need to say, hey, maybe we don't have all the answers ourselves, but here's reasons why we think our answers are better than your answers, looking at the same data set.
So you're sort of saying that they're on the right path, they just come up with the wrong conclusion. Because I know one of the big arguments in the skeptic community is, should you be debating things that are sort of settled issues? So, and in doing so, aren't you giving them a stage to, A, promote their ideas, and, two, give them a certain amount of credibility with regards to that?
Yeah, I'm not sure you give credibility to a position merely by giving it a voice in the public sphere. The fact is, this stuff is out there, and it's worth giving, say, Dr. Ross an opportunity to state his case, and then to have somebody say, well, you know, I think your case is severely problematic, ultimately fails, irretrievably. And here's why. Because there might be folks who go, okay, well, you know, maybe evolution's a settled matter, maybe cosmology is a settled or settling matter. But nobody, myself included, has the sufficient expertise to have read enough, deeply enough, into all these fields to be able to say why these things are. So this is a nice chance to have, say, someone defending old Earth creationism, which would be Dr. Ross, to talk against somebody who's going, well, now, wait a minute, I think an agnostic view makes a lot more sense.
If it's not giving away any trade secrets, what kind of prep have you been doing for this debate?
Well, I've been, you know, running 2 kilometers a night uphill, doing 150 push-ups.
Listening to the theme from Rocky,
drinking raw eggs.
My approach is actually not going to be one that's drowning in data. I mean, I'm interested in three broad fields. I'm interested in cosmology from the physics point of view. I'm interested in biodiversity, which would be biological evolution. And I'm interested in abiogenesis, which I think are also areas that Dr. Ross is going to focus on. My general strategy is going to be to take it from a period of historical epochs. And 10,000 years ago, well, we knew a heck of a lot, right? We knew how to channel water. We knew how to plant crops. We knew how to tax. We knew how to kill. We knew how to organize armies. But we didn't really know much about where all this stuff came from that we were digging channels in, and where food was coming from, and where were those armies coming from that we had to go out and kill. And so the first round of hypothesis generation came along, and I think that would be ancient religion. And you kind of fast forward through time, and what you end up discovering is that the more attention we pay directly to the phenomena of the world around us, the more and more, pleasingly it seemed, we were able to discover what the heck's actually going on in the world. So, for instance, hey, those things that we thought were fires in the sky, well, they're these things called stars, and they're really far away, and that's why they don't fall down from the sky. And move forward, and hey, actually, there's anatomy inside these bodies of ours. It's not just these kind of vague humors floating around controlling our personalities and longevity. And what the broad way I'm going to approach this argument is that the further and further science has gone, the more successful simple naturalistic explanations have been. So probabilistically, the space for God, which made a lot of sense 10,000 years ago, because 10,000 years ago, if you made something, that took a maker. And the world as we saw it appeared to be a something. Something's required makers. Well, maybe there's a maker, a big maker, and we don't know much about the big maker. But as we've discovered, the thing that's so radical about an idea like evolution is that you can get actually exquisite complexity with no designer at all, other than nature itself and its fickle ways. And as you look at cosmology, it's starting to look like, well, it's not in the bank yet, but it looks like, well, maybe you can get a universe from nothing at all. And if we hold to Occam's razor not to multiply entities beyond necessity, where is the room and the need for the entity we call God, or maybe called the Big Maker? It seems that there's just less and less for that being to do through time, perhaps not even anything at all of great significance.
Just to get in my cheap shot here, obviously one of the places they say you need God is for morals, as the Catholic Church has proven recently.
Right. Well, I have one final question for Dr. Rob here, and that is on the subject of science and religion. In your professional career as a scientist, have you encountered a lot of religion in science?
Well, I should make one quick correction. A physician would be more like an applied scientist. I'd be more like you bring your car in and get it fixed, except your car is yourself. Within medicine, there's probably maybe a higher rate of religious adherence than, say, within academic science. But it's fascinating that as you look at groups of individuals, the higher their education level, the less religious adherence they seem to have, ultimately until you get up to the National Academy of Science, which would be an elite group of highly educated, highly accomplished science, where rates of religious adherence drop to statistical insignificance.
Interesting. Well, we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so special thanks to Dr. Rob Tarzel for coming by to talk to us.
You're most welcome.
Hopefully this episode will make it to the podcast.
that reminds me, Rob, my back, it's hurting a little bit. Can you give me
perhaps after the show.
Yeah, let's not do that on the air. How about that? Well, there's a few skeptical highlights to announce. Not surprisingly, CFI and Reasons to Believe are putting on a debate on Friday the 16th called Putting God to the Test at 7 p.m. at UBC Woodward Building Number 2 featuring Dr. Rob Tarzwell. And then to continue that debate, on the 17th, there'll be another one called What's Right and What's Wrong with Christianity at the 10th Avenue Church in Vancouver, and that'll be with Dr. Hugh Ross and UBC Freethinker Brian Lynch-Ahan.
There's another CFI Vancouver-sponsored event. It's a public lecture being given on April 22nd by me on the topic of the lying brain.
So check out our calendar for those awesome events.
How am I supposed to believe that, Rob? I mean, it's a lying brain. You just proved that it obviously isn't going to be bought then.
Come to my talk and you'll find out.
Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying good night.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist, saying have a good evening.
This is Daniel saying thanks for listening.
And thanks for having me.
Government. and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister... Sotra, 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 Sotra